I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. I'm currently reading an astonishingly good book, Your Voice in My Head. It's a memoir from the writer Emma Forrest, who takes us through her life. On the surface, it's a sort of charmed existence, a talented young writer at 16 with a column in the Sunday Times. She wrote for The Guardian at 21, the same year she published her first novel, Name Dropper. Two more followed, Thin Skin and Cherries in the Snow, plus a life in the glare of pop culture photographers thanks to someone prominent she was dating at the time. But it all unravels as her quirks and eccentricities become damaging to her psyche. She recounts her struggles with cutting and bulimia, the cruel relationship she finds herself in, as well as the effects of such crushing depression. And she's just over 30 years old now. It's wonderfully written, and Emma Forrest joins me now to talk about the book. Worked through in the book is her relationship with her psychiatrist who saved her life. The relationship sort of begins after he dies, and she pieces together who he was, in a way paying tribute to all that he did to save her. EmmaForrest.com is her website. She lives in Los Angeles, where she is a screenwriter. Your Voice in My Head is published by Random House. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Emma Forrest. Good morning, Ms. Forrest.
Hi, how are you?
Very good, yourself.
Good, thank you for having me.
So, everyone is wondering about a certain acting celebrity.
Wow, you got right in there. They usually wait until the end.
Yeah, and I can't promise that I won't ask about Colin Farrell, but early in the book, you go to the movies with Gary Shandling?
Oh, yeah, do you know what? Half my life I've forgotten about. I once went to the movies with a friend who brought us their special surprise guest star to the night, Gary Shandling, indeed.
Yeah, no, so your friend knew Gary Shandling,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. And so he's such a, I don't know how to, like, I'm a fan of his.
Yeah.
But he doesn't seem like a guy that I'd like to hang around with.
Well, I can't really answer that because he clearly didn't want to hang around with me. He ran away.
Yeah, yeah. Did you actually go to the movies, or
yeah.
How? Yeah. But I guess you don't really talk during a movie, right?
No, and also, I mean, I was in such a peculiar place at that time, I don't think I could have really had a especially rational conversation.
Yeah. So when people talk about the book, or the press that one reads about the book, invariably the famous name that I've already mentioned comes up. So let's get that out of the way. What in the book is about him?
I've never said it's about Colin Farrell, and I never will, but I know that everyone else will say that, so I just can't, I can't answer that. But the really lovely thing is that I've been getting letters lately from people who say that it's just universal heartbreak, and that, you know, it doesn't matter if it was an actor or a famous person or who it was. They've all had that feeling of just not being able to move past a breakup. So it's been nice for me that while the press is sort of fixated on who that person is, I am getting letters from people who are saying, look, we don't care.
In the book, there's a character, someone that you're involved with, and they're referred to as the gypsy husband.
Yeah.
One of the things that I was wondering about, because you're a writer, was whether G.H., gypsy husband, was a writer himself.
Yes, not professionally, but yes, definitely someone who is a brilliant writer, for sure.
Yeah. As I said, it's a wonderfully written book. Growing up, was writing something that you were naturally good at, say, at an early age?
Yeah, it was. I'm one of those people who, I hate learning. I hate learning how to do things. I only do things that I'm good at without having to try, and so my mum always says she's amazed I know how to read and write, because I was probably just too young to figure out that I hate learning how to do stuff. I don't know how to drive, I don't know how to play any musical instruments, I don't know how to speak any language, but writing is something that has always been a pleasure for me and has always been easy for me.
And because, you see, we were always taught and we're told that writing is not something that one can be born with, it's something that we have to practice to be good at.
Well, I do think for sure that the way you become a good writer is by writing. I don't think that means you have to study it, but I do think that if you are a writer, you need to write every single day.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter whether the writing you do every day is good or not, just the practice and the discipline of, even if it's just putting in an hour to keep everything open, is vital.
And do you find that even blogging helps that?
It does. I tell you what's very unhelpful, and I'm about to delete my account, is Twitter, which publishers always want authors to be on Twitter because it's seen as a very good promotional tool. But I find that notion of having to write in 140 characters or less, and that constant flashing of information and just little granules of information, when I then go to do my quote-unquote real writing, my concentration is just ruined, and my ability to focus for a sustained period. So Twitter, I think, is actually really damaging, but I do think blogging is a good idea because one of my favorite writers, Allen Ginsberg, talked about when he wrote the poem Howl, this notion of breaking down the things that you would tell your muse versus the things that you would tell your best friend in private. And blogging is quite a good way to break down that wall, I think.
What was your childhood like?
It was really good in the sense that I had and have, they're still alive and they're still together, really wonderful parents who were very funny, very smart, very gifted, and really loving. And that's when people, you know, usually jump in and say, well, how did you end up so messed up? That was all of my own creation. And so all the aspects of my childhood that were unhappy were sort of self-created. And I was very different from other kids and not popular and pretty tormented and bullied throughout. Well, in England, it would be junior school. I'm not sure what it would be here. In middle school, and then in high school I just left. You know, I left at 15. But certainly my home life was very happy. It was the inside of my head that was not happy.
Your dad and his notes, they're really neat, the notes that he'd write you and so on. Did you really find, I shouldn't say really, did you need to write this book?
Yeah, I did. And the deal I made with myself was I could feel I needed to write it, so I would write it, and then I didn't have to publish it if I didn't think it was good, because a lot of the time that people are just compelled to write something, it isn't necessarily that good. You know, when it's a passion piece, it can be hard to have distance and a reality about whether it's a good example of your work or not. But when I was finished, I thought it was good, and I gave it to my agent and my editor, who... I had a novel right before this that I didn't finish because when I gave it to them, they're like, this is not good. This is not working. So they're quite honest with me, and they've been in my life since I was a teenager. And they said, no, this is wonderful. Publish it.
And is it easier writing about yourself?
Well, I think that I'm always writing about myself, whether it's
Even
if it's a version of myself in novels, I think, what is it they say, that your first five novels are always about you? It's only after five that you break free. I think that what was nice about novels and screenplays is I can create the superhero version of myself, the one who does the things that I don't dare to do, or the one who, you know, escapes. And with the memoir, what's tough is really saying how bad my behavior could be, because that was important as well, was that I had to be toughest on myself. I had to be tougher on me than on anyone else in the book, was important. And so there are things, so many things in there that I'm not proud of. I don't come across well. I you know, obsessive and couldn't leave that relationship and couldn't move on and couldn't get it together. And that's humiliating. You know, you want to say, and I was fine. I walked off into the sunset. I was fine, and that just wasn't the case for me. It was really awful, and it felt very embarrassing to write down, but it was the truth.
One of the things that surprises me about memoirs and the writers who write them and come on here is how willing they are to discussing things that probably I wouldn't. Mm. You mentioned that you don't come off well in the book. Mm. Was there a chance that you would have held back something?
To make me seem more likable.
Yeah, or I mean, and do you hold back anything at all? It seems that you don't.
What I do hold back on is any discussion of people's children, because a couple of the boyfriends in my life had children, and those relationships were really interesting to me because they're a big part of why the relationship either did or didn't work. But I just felt that ethically for me was off topic and not something that I touched, although it may have explained more to the reader if I had. So that's pretty much the only thing I held back.
When we read the jacket of the book, and say we find the book at a bookstore, and we read what you've gone through, we automatically have a view about you. The view that maybe you're damaged. How do you get people what do you do in the book to get people away from the notion, whatever notions they have about mental illness or the stigma of it?
I don't know if I do that, because I know certainly when people meet me in person, when they come to interview me, they're really shocked by how together I am, and I think they were expecting someone a lot more fragile and a lot more frail. I think that, I don't know, I'm surprised sometimes when I hear that there is still a stigma about mental illness. I know that in England, where I was raised, that they're so welcoming to discussing these topics now, I think, because they were so repressed about it for so long. And certainly it's, you know, a huge culture in America of Oprah culture and talking about things and examining the soul. So is it, you can answer for me, is it perhaps a Canadian taboo still?
Probably not. I think it's a male thing.
Yeah.
Do you think that's the case?
Yeah. I mean, you know, my dad, who is so wonderful and who I'm so close to, you can see in the book that he uses humor as a shield, so he doesn't really have to confront just how bad things are. And that is male, I think. And sometimes you look at people like that and go, God, I hope they stay bottled up, because if they ever started unbottling, it would all be over, you know.
Yeah. So how bad did it get for you?
Well, it's all there in the book. It got bad, it got dark. In a way, the scariest part is when you start to get well, because once you start to get well, you can see clearly for the first time with an unfoggy mind just how much work you have to do, and just how life is not easy, and life is pretty sad. You know, there's a lot of happiness to it as well, but it isn't going to get any easier, and that's, in a way, even tougher than being right in the thick of it, because at least then you're just a mess. You can't get out of bed. You know, but once you start to engage in life, you go, Jesus, this is going to be a long road.
And so you talk about the psychiatrist you saw in New York, Dr. R. How long had you been seeing him?
I saw him for the best part of a decade. And when I was living in New York, obviously, it was face-to-face, and when I moved out to L.A. for the last couple of years, it was over-the-phone sessions, and then I would go and see him when I was back in New York, like 3 or 4 times a year.
And so he died of cancer, right?
He did. He had lung cancer. It was diagnosed, and he passed 8 months later.
Yeah. And so you had no idea that he was sick?
No, none of his patients did.
Yeah.
He was such an optimist that he actually didn't think he was going to die. It never crossed his mind that he would die, and that's why he didn't tell us. He thought that it would be fine just to go from chemo to sessions and say he had flu or was under the weather, and it really was right at the bitter end that people started to find out.
Part of the book is your journey to sort of find out more about him. I guess when you're in therapy, you don't get a chance to know the doctor.
Yeah.
Was that something that you needed to do as well?
Yes, because I felt a sense of betrayal and disappointment, and this was a man I just held in such high esteem, and I just felt so let down. And of course, part of the book is this journey to realizing people have the right to die how they want to die. And that's what he did.
You talked to the family, and
yeah, and actually his widow loves the book so much that she's asked in future editions for me to put his full name.
Yeah, and what was the reticence to just put the initial?
Was that when I put the book, the idea together, I wouldn't have written it without her blessing, without his wife's blessing, but she asked for him to be anonymized. But once she had read the book, she changed her mind.
Yeah. What do we need to know about Dr. R? In the book, you write about him a great deal in the book. Mm. What do you want us to know about him?
Well, there are specific things and non-specific things. The thing that's specific to him is that he had faith in us when we had no faith in ourselves, and that's why his treatment was so successful. You know, he was the ultimate optimist. In the non-specific, it's that therapy, counseling, psychiatry, it is good for anyone, whether you think you have a problem or not. Just the idea of having a relationship where you're never going to see that person in any context except that room once a week for 1 hour. You just talk in a different way than you do even with your best friends, even with family that you adore. It's a very, very useful tool.
There are points in your life where the reader might say or might wonder what the cause of the whole mania is. How do you put this together? I mean, it's about you, but yeah, there's obviously a lot of stuff that you don't remember, as you've said. Mm. Do you do research to put a book like this together?
Well, I have all the journals from years and years of journaling. I have all the hospital records from various hospital visits over the years. I have the testimony of the people who watched it all unfold, and I had access, obviously, to his widow and access to the other patients, and that's sort of how it got pieced together.
You told Variety that everything is copy.
Yeah.
In your life. Do you find people don't want to get close to you less it's fodder for material?
Yeah, that's actually a Nora Ephron line that I was quoting, and I've wondered about someone like her, how it works for her. She's in a happy marriage of many decades, so it may take a while, but I guess eventually you find someone who's okay with it. But not everyone will be, and that is a deal of which I'm aware, that there are people who will not want to get close to me, and I believe strongly enough in the writing that I accept that. But there are relationships I just won't be able to have.
And the writing helps you stay well, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you find that, you've been in Canada for a while now promoting this book.
Yeah.
Has the book been released in the States yet? Or?
It comes out next in the States, May 1st.
Yeah. Do you find that audiences in Britain and Canada, in the United States, do you think that they'll get different things out of the book? Or?
Yeah, definitely. So it's come out now in England, in Canada, in Australia, and next it will be America. And it will be really interesting to see, because like I say, you know, we think of America as this very, very Oprah-fied culture of talk therapy. Perhaps it's the point where, you know, while the other cultures are turning towards it, England and Australia and Canada, there may be a sense that they're turning away from it. I know that the American publishers were very concerned about people thinking it was a book about a psychiatrist. That worried them, and I said, but that is, you know, the big pull of the story, and I think they wrote doctor on the doctor who saved her life rather than the psychiatrist. Now, of course, he was a doctor, but that was sort of a sleight of hand that seems to be something about the American market not wanting to talk about it anymore.
Yeah. I mentioned, we talked earlier about how you needed to write this book, that it was a sort of catharsis.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, there's something instructive here, isn't there, for the reader?
I hope so, only in the sense of having unnameable things named. I mean, it's not prescriptive. I don't tell people what to do. I can only say what worked for me, and that I'm alive, and that it's worth being alive, and that the best thing to do if there is darkness in your life is to try and make something out of it. That is my tool, that's my coping mechanism, and it really works for me. Not everyone is in the creative arts, but I do still think that journaling, just trying to create some kind of art, even if it's just for your private life, out of any darkness you're dealing with, is really useful.
So what's next for you, Emma?
I'm actually right now adapting the book as a movie, because UK Film Council has optioned it.
And I read somewhere that you're working on another script, the Debbie Harry thing.
Yeah, there's a lot of movie work right now. Yes, a biopic of Blondie.
Yeah.
Which is really, really fun.
Do you find that the writing? I mean, the writing is obviously different if you're writing a novel, say, or a memoir, as opposed to screenwriting. Is there a great difference for you?
I find screenwriting is a really nice structure for me, because naturally I tend to get lost in characters and dialogue, and screenwriting sort of already has a structure imposed on it that I find quite useful, so that's why that's become my favorite, actually.
Emma, I'm really enjoying the book. Congratulations on it, and continued good luck with it.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. The website's for more, emmaforrest.com. The book is called Your Voice in My Head. It's published by Random House. Its author, Emma Forrest, on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.